Epilogue. Beaucourt, France, 4 weeks later. Remy pulled their rented Citroen into a tree-lined gravel driveway and followed it 100 yards to a two-story white stuccoed farmhouse with gabled windows framed by black shutters. She stopped beside the picket fence and shut off the engine. To the right of the house was a rectangular garden, its black soil tilled and ready for planting. A paving stone walkway led through the gate to the door. "If we're right about this," Remy said, "we're about to change a girl's life." "For the better," Sam replied. "She deserves it." Following the confrontation in the cave, they'd spent 2 hours making their way back to the entrance, Remy climbing ahead, setting pitons and rock screws, and taking as much of Sam's weight as she could. Sam refused to let her go for help. They'd come down together, and they were going back up together. Once outside, Sam made himself comfortable while Remy sprinted back to the hotel, where she called for help. The next day, they were at the hospital in Martigny. The bullet had missed any major organs, but left Sam feeling like he'd been used as a boxer's heavy bag. He was kept 2 days for observation and then released. 3 days later, they were back in San Diego, where Selma explained how Bondaruk and Kolkoff had tracked them to the Grand San Bernard. One of the security guards sent by Rube's friend had been approached days earlier by Kolkoff and given an ultimatum: install the keylogger or see his 2 daughters kidnapped. Putting themselves in the man's shoes, Sam and Remy couldn't fault the choice he made. The police were left out of it. The next morning, they started the process of returning the Caryatides to the Greek government. Their first call went to Evelyn Torres, who immediately contacted the director of the Delphi Archaeological Museum. From there, events moved rapidly, and within a week, an expedition sponsored by the Hellenic Ministry of Culture was in the cave beneath the Grand San Bernard Lake. On its second day inside, the team found a side cavern. Inside were dozens of Spartan and Persian skeletons, along with their weapons and equipment. It would be weeks before the expedition would attempt to extract the columns from the cave, Evelyn reported, but the ministry was certain the Caryatides would safely find their way home and eventually be put on display at the museum. Before the year was out, scholars the world over were going to have to rethink a good portion of Greek and Persian history. Hadean Bondaruk had died, never laying eyes on his beloved and elusive Caryatides. Once Sam was fully on the mend, they returned their attention to the lost cellar. According to the legend, Napoleon had ordered his enologist, Henri-Émile Archambault, to produce 12 bottles of the Lacano wine. Sam and Remy could account for only 5. 1 lost by Manfred Bohem and destroyed, based on the Pocomoke shard found by Ted Frobisher. 3 recovered by them, aboard the Moch, at St. Bartholomew's and in the Tradonico family catacombs in Obertange. And finally, the bottle stolen by Kolkoff from the Marder at Rum Key and presumably delivered to Hadean Bondaruk at his estate, an issue the French and Ukrainian governments were working to settle. For their part, Sam and Remy had already turned over their bottles to France's Ministry of Culture, which had offered an endowment of $750,000 to the Fargo Foundation. $250,000 per bottle. One mystery remained. What had happened to the other 7 bottles? Were they lost, or were they somewhere waiting to be discovered, either superfluous parts of Napoleon's riddle or hidden for their own safety? The answer, Sam and Remy decided, might lie with the man who'd started the legend of the lost cellar, the smuggler captain of the Faucon, Lionel Arien, whom Laurent had allegedly hired to help stash the bottles. As far as they could tell, Napoleon had been willing to trust only Laurent with the task, and they'd gone to great lengths to ensure the bottles remained hidden. Why then had Laurent enlisted the help of a random sea captain he met in a Le Havre tavern? It was a question that would take 2 weeks to answer. Their first stop was the Newberry Library in Chicago, where they spent 3 days sorting through the Spencer collection, home to arguably the largest gathering of Napoleon original source material in the United States. From there, they flew to Paris, spending 4 days and 3 days, respectively, at the Bibliothèque Nationale de France and the Defense Archives at Château de Vincennes. Finally, armed with a legal pad full of notes, copies of birth and death certificates, discharge documents, and transfer records, they drove west to Rouen, the capital of the Normandy province. There, in the basement of the provincial archives, they found the last link in the chain. In September 1818, Sergeant Léon Ariane Pelletier, a decorated veteran grenadier in Napoleon's reserve army and subordinate of Arnaud Laurent during the 1800 Italian campaign, was discharged for reasons unrecorded and returned to his home in Beaucourt, 115 miles east of the port of Le Havre. 2 months later, he disappeared from Beaucourt, resurfaced in Le Havre with a new set of identity papers, and purchased a 3-masted bark named the Zodiac. The ship cost more than a sergeant could have made in 8 lifetimes in the French army. He changed the Zodiac's name to Falcon and began smuggling arms and liquor up and down the coast, making modest profits and, astoundingly, not once running afoul of the French authorities. 2 years later, in June of 1820, Arnaud Laurent walked into a pub and hired Lionel Ariane and the Falcon. 12 months after that, Ariane returned to Le Havre, sold the Falcon, and returned home to Beaucourt, where he slowly but steadily drank and gambled away his fortune. Why Pelletier Ariane had chosen to reveal the secret on his deathbed, neither Sam nor Remy knew, but it seemed clear that he, Laurent, and Napoleon were the only ones who'd known about the Siphonian caryatides. Nor would they probably ever know how the three men had found the columns in the first place. Selma's completed translation of Laurent's diary codebook had solved 2 smaller riddles. 10 months after he and Ariane picked up the wine from St. Helena, having spent nearly a year secreting bottles around the world, they received word Napoleon had died. Heartbroken, but already en route to Marseille, Laurent hid 3 bottles at Chateau d'If before returning to port. Of the other bottles, he'd said nothing. As to why Napoleon's son, Napoleon II, never took up the quest his father had devised for him, this too was a source of despair for Laurent. From the time he returned to France with Ariane to his death in 1825, Laurent wrote Napoleon II dozens of letters begging him to obey his father's wishes. But Napoleon II refused, stating he saw no reason to leave the comforts of the Austrian royal court for a childish game of hide-and-go-seek. Sergeant Léon Ariane Pelletier, it turned out, had 1 living descendant, a distant cousin named Louisa Fouque. She was 21 and deep in debt after her parents had died in a car crash a year earlier and left her a thrice-mortgaged Beaucourt farmhouse. "How do you think she'll take it?" Remy asked. "Let's find out. One way or another, her life is about to change." They climbed out of the car and walked up the path to the front door. Remy pulled a leather cord and a bell tinkled. A few moments later, the door opened to reveal a petite woman with light brown hair and a button nose. "Oui?" she said. "Bonjour. Louisa Fouque?" "Oui." Remy introduced herself and Sam, then asked if Louisa spoke English.
"Yes, I speak English."
"May we come in? We have some information about your family. About Léon Pelletier. Do you know the name?"
"I think so. My father showed me our genealogy once. Please, come in."
Inside, they found a kitchen done in quintessential French provincial. Yellow plaster walls, a lacquered oak dining table, and a sage-green sideboard displaying a few pieces of chinoiserie pottery. Cheerful orange-checkered toile curtains framed the windows. Louisa made tea, and they sat down at the table. Remy said, "Your English is very good." I was studying American literature at Amiens, but I had to quit. There was a... I had some family problems.
We know, Sam replied. We're very sorry.
Louisa nodded, forced a smile.
You said you have some information about my family?
Taking turns, Sam and Remy outlined their theory about Pelletier, the lost cellar, and their connection to the Siphonian caryatides. Remy pulled a half-dozen newspaper clippings from her purse and slid them across the table to Louisa, who scanned the articles.
I read about this, she said. You were involved?
Sam nodded.
I can't believe it. I had no idea. My mother and father never said anything.
I'm sure they didn't know. Aside from Napoleon and Laurent, Pelletier was the only other person, and he kept the secret up until his death. Even then, he didn't tell the whole story.
No one believed him.
Almost no one, Remy said with a smile. Louisa was silent for half a minute, then shook her head in wonderment.
Well, thank you for telling me. It's nice to know someone in our family did something important. A little strange, but important still.
Sam and Remy exchanged a glance. I don't think we've made ourselves clear, Sam said. There are some bottles still unaccounted for. Louisa blinked at them.
And you think... here?
Sam pulled out his iPhone and pulled up a picture of a cicada. Have you ever seen this anywhere? In response, Louisa got up and walked to the pot rack hanging above the sink. She pulled down a sauté pan and set it on the table before Sam. The handle was a thumb-sized steel rod. Set into its end was a cicada stamp. It was identical to the one they'd found in Laurent's crypt.
My father found that in the attic a few years ago, Louisa said. He didn't know what it was for, so he used it to fix the pan.
Remy asked, Do you have a basement? While their research into Sergeant Pelletier had uncovered a number of surprises, it had also challenged one of their basic assumptions, that Laurent alone had placed the bottles in their hiding spots. Having spent so much time consumed by the chase, they'd begun to think like Laurent and Pelletier, and so it took them only 15 minutes to find what they'd come for. In the northwest corner of the basement, beneath a wall next to the root cellar, they found a block bearing the cicada stamp. As usual, Sam did the prying, Remy the probing. Louisa stood behind them with a flashlight. Remy slid her hand out of the hole and got to her knees.
Seven,
she said.
Oh, my Lord,
Louisa breathed. Remy scooted aside so the girl could kneel down and look for herself.
How long have they been there?
190 years, give or take, Sam replied.
What happens now?
Remy smiled.
Louisa? You're rich.
You pay off the farm, go back to school, and live happily ever after. Hand in hand, Sam and Remy walked out the front door to their car.
We got 11 bottles out of 12, Remy said. Not bad.
Better than not bad. Think about it. Those bottles survived a trip around the world, the fall of Napoleon, and 2 world wars. I'd call that miraculous.
Good point. I have to say, I feel a little let down.
About?
The end of the adventure, Remy said wistfully.
The end? Not on your life. Paddy Cannon's treasure is still out there, and we've got most of the Pocomoke Swamp left to search. Remy laughed.
And after that?
After that, we pick a spot on the map and go. This is Scott Brick. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Spartan Gold by Clive Cussler with Grant Blackwood.